Some economists believe that the Federal Reserve's policy of sticking with high interest rates is a sound and reasonable one, but increasingly many others are saying that the high rates could end up crashing the economy. Thomas Ferguson is the research director for the Institute of New Economic Thinking. Along with his colleague Service Storm, he says the Fed's monetary tightening reinforces the dual nature of the U.S. economy. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg about the Fed's inflation-fighting strategy and related issues.
What's the Fed doing about inflation? Are they pursuing policies that would help the economy, do you think? Or I guess you've suggested they're playing chicken.
Well, my colleague Servais Storm and I wrote a piece, actually a couple of pieces on this, so it's not just my view here. But, you know, I'm sure they're trying to help the economy, we all trust. But no, I don't think they are. There's not much of a secret about this either. Almost every day now comes somebody's pronouncement, even sometimes inside the Fed structures itself, saying, you know, we're holding interest rates up rather too long. And why would you run the risk of a recession, as one economist said the other day? Yeah, I mean, so our take on this is, why indeed are they doing it? Now, our answer is somewhat different within the standard story, which is, look, it's when you sort of look at what's actually happened, you can see that a big amount of inflation has dropped a lot. I mean, the so-called supply-side components are way down. On the other hand, service sector inflation is very sticky. It's much higher than the general rate of inflation. That bugs the Fed. That's pretty clear. It would bug anybody. When you sort of then probe a little bit further beneath that, you can sort of see, well, they pretty clearly think they have a wage price problem in that sector. That is to say, you have a catch up in workers. There are folks who disagree with that, but they're not in the majority. And I mean, not only the Fed, but nearly everybody in sort of mainstream economics spends most of their time agonizing about wage price spirals when, you know, the big story in the last 3 years has been we're all behind on average. I mean, workers have lost a lot.
That hasn't happened in a long time, right? That traditional or classic wage price.
No, that's right. No, you're right. And it's like this has not been the problem in this last few years. And back to the sort of main thread, which is that so Servais and I just looked at this and said, well, you know what? The problem here is pretty straightforward. Just take everybody's normal estimates of what so-called wealth effects are. Wealth effect meaning the extra impact on consumption spending. That are spending in general, but certainly consumption spending mostly, that you're going to get from a big increase in wealth. And then when you look at that, you see, good Lord, since 2020, when the Fed did its huge quantitative easing program, it briefly came out of it, then went right back into it. First, the housing markets, and then also the financial markets soared. They're both near records right now. Not today. I think they fell a tiny amount from where they were last week. They were at records last week. And just take that normal estimate of spending and then plug it into the big numbers that you actually see in wealth, and you get absolutely stunning numbers there. And folks don't talk about this. They don't recognize it. Huge numbers of people enormously resented it when we first brought it up. Fed still doesn't want to acknowledge it. And you can see how gingerly, I've had discussions with reporters, for example, where they talk quite straightforwardly to me about this. Then they actually will bring it up with somebody else from the Fed, but they don't write about it. They don't want to discuss specific arguments, say those in our paper. People know this is happening. You know, you get economists now, even in Visa and elsewhere, saying this. And so our take is, look, why don't we recognize that a huge chunk of this service sector inflation, the sticky price qualities of that, are coming from this giant surge in spending? And the thing you got to recognize about that is that this giant surge in spending is not going to go away by raising interest rates. I mean, unless you want to crash the whole economy. I mean, you can obviously wreck the wealth in the whole place. You can do a Paul Volcker style 1979-1980 giant rate rises. What they're not doing that. In fact, what the Fed does is they sort of keep it where it is. They don't cut it. And they're really just sort of sitting around looking for something to turn up, hoping that maybe something will drop. Because I mean, I think they see too the problem. And so that's our point, that, hey, guys, we need a better way to deal with this type of problem than just this sort of stupid tool of raising interest rates, which when it's spending from the wealthy in the face of record stock and housing markets, well, just forget it. That's not going to cure the problem. It just won't. You can talk until you're blue in the face, but it won't change that fact.
So how does the Fed policy affect most of the population, not the big investors, not the super wealthy?
All right. I mean, it wasn't me. It was Claudia Sahm the other day, a former Fed economist, who kept pointing out to the steady rise in unemployment. And it's obviously costing everybody on every interest rate that's hitched. You know, it's one of the miracles of inflation accounting that typically interest rates don't actually show in things like the CPI. There are good reasons for that. There are a lot of, I think, also bad reasons that they ought not to, because they used to be in there at one point. But the point is, no, we're all paying. The rest of us are all paying. And in effect, what you've got here is a dual economy. I mean, some another point that Sir Buzz Storm and I made in our paper, which is on the INET website, I guess I should add. You've got, in effect, one economy for the rich and the other, and another economy for everybody else. And you can see the sort of craziness of this over time. I mean, the wealth effects and spending effects are now so huge. They are restructuring very substantial chunks of the economy. You can see, for example, that, you know, you go back to, say, 2018, 19, 20 as a baseline, the employment in nursing homes and wages have just not recovered. What you're doing is you're pulling a lot of low-wage workers out of stuff where they used to do reasonable social stuff with a reasonable effects on society at large, including daycare, and you're pulling them into things like high-end dining. I mean, at this point, waving small details like any number of chains that you and I can probably make up, but which we will not push any in particular here, waving a few chains, almost all dining has become high-end dining now. You know, it's like this, just growing this can't make sense, I think, over the long run. But anyway, that's what we're doing. The whole economy is restructuring under the effect of wealth. But the wealth effect on consumption spending is very large. And so that inflation in service sectors is going to stay up for a long time. You need something else to deal with it.
So this idea that there's two economies, one for the very wealthy and one for the rest of us, is that any different than what's existed before? Or do you think it's just to a greater degree?
It's worse. And in particular, this. Now, this goes back to a couple papers that, again, I think Servais and I wrote a year ago. But we're not the only ones to observe this. Is I actually think a lot of low-wage sectors are collapsing. And or sectors where they can't keep wages up high enough. That actually, as weird as this sounds, also covers a good bit of healthcare, because you can see that the job conditions. Now, this is not just a question of, if you like, price adjustment in an existing structure. Healthcare is going through a structural transformation as private equity gobbles more and more of it. And so what you see is that the healthcare executives' pay tends to stay up almost regardless, while nurses and even doctors are complaining, and they're all beefing about both safety and hours. I mean, it's just crazy to have people doing like 6-day shifts or you know, full day shifts.
But in the case of nurses, they do have unions in many cases that can negotiate for them.
In some cases, yes. But the general, I think there's no doubt at all that there's a very substantial flow of people out of nursing. There's not one, but many complaints about this and many studies of it. And indeed, I just saw this morning a demand, well, let's change law on visas so we can get more foreign nurses in. We can certainly use nurses. I'm equivocal about pulling nurses from other countries. What you do is you pull them out, typically out of developing countries, which don't have any then. But you know, they should solve these problems. Now, I don't think collective bargaining is going to fix this. Collective bargaining has not fixed it now for 2 or 3 years. And indeed, you can see there are even some strikes over this. You don't need strikes. We have a bankruptcy in southeastern Massachusetts right now that is by where the executives have done extremely well. It was a private equity operation that then sold it off. And Stewart Healthcare, it's all over the news everywhere in the Northeast. And it's even showing up, I think, in some congressional hearings. This kind of stuff's all over. Healthcare is just one place, though. Just in general, there are a bunch of sectors, I think, where this is true. Nursing homes is another one, which is really scary. They just can't retain people, as far as I can tell. And in educational institutions, there's a steady attrition, though not everywhere. It depends on the what district you're in. You know, you're in a fairly rich suburban district, your wages generally rise, though maybe not to completely cover. In poor districts, that's not obvious at all. And universities are straggled out all over the place.
Does what you're talking about with the Fed and related issues, do those sort of issues come up in political campaigns? Have you seen that at all?
Well, it depends. I mean,
or maybe in an indirect way.
Indirectly, a lot, right? I mean, it's clear. I mean, you see the Biden administration's economists are claiming all these wage gains for people. Now, there are all these discussions of why people don't buy it. In fact, you know, as Storm and I showed you in great detail in our long paper there, the working paper, and I know, these wage gains are largely illusory. Most people have lost under inflation. I'm just repeating that point in that context makes the point very clear. When I look around the world at the European elections, including the UK, basically what I'm seeing is that hardly any party that presided over inflation has really survived. I mean, the sort of periodic the crux of the issue in this election is to a considerable extent, I think, you know, if it's just a referendum on economic performance, it's not going to go super well for Biden. But it's probably not just a referendum on economic. I mean, it's not like Brand X. It's not another one of these in, out, out in deals where you just vote for the out party and just don't worry about it. Everybody knows what those are, but I'm not willing myself to go into politics either. Here, I'm old fashioned. I think we should stick to, you know, the economic side of this, and that I'm happy to talk about. But yeah, I mean, I think inflation is an issue. It was an issue. I mean, it's striking the way press coverage in the United States of the European elections, both the recent European parliamentary elections and more specifically now the French elections, they carry on as though the issue were principally immigration. You know, if you can read even a little French, you'd know that's not true. The question of
it's what the right wing emphasizes, but yeah.
Yeah, it's everybody out of power is emphasizing it. And, you know, it's pretty obvious. So, you know, it's not easy to be a regime with high inflation. Now, you can come back, and I'm sympathetic only up to a point on this, that, well, you had, you know, supply shortages, supply side problems, which, you know, that's what Stormont, I think, too, you know, is a basic cause of the inflation. I think, on the other hand, people could have dealt with that better. I would have, in particular, insisted on port restructurings and forcing the carriers to cooperate much faster than people did. And I'm going to leave that to other people. I think Peter Goodman's new book on supply problems in the world economy has some discussions of that. But that's a different discussion.
So in the U.S., at least, or maybe in other countries, do you think we'll ever get away from this idea that if the economy is perceived to be good, the president gets credit, and if the economy is perceived to be bad, the president is blamed? Is that going to continue, do you think?
Well, we're all going to find out, I think. I'm not a believer in that as a sort of infallible rule. I mean, I've been looking at elections for a long time, and I certainly got the point of the old economic theories of elections, which was basically, I mean, the old versions of that sort of depended usually on median disposable income in the last few quarters before the election. Median's okay, but the average ones, you know, that has become kind of a the strange yardstick as incomes have become so fantastically unequal. But if you can get it, and you can't really in enough time to do good election predictions, you might be able to make something. But they don't explain everything. There's always stuff floating around. I mean, I'm a big believer in the role of money in elections. And, you know, Paul Jorgensen and G. Chen and I have published a lot on that. And, you know, we find the correlation of campaign spending in House elections, where you've got hundreds of cases, not one-offs, to be very strong, usually like 80.8, things like that, which is a very high level. That said, you know, there's still enough. That means, you know, the other part is still out there. And look, I'm going to tell you right now, I just abstract, this is not a political comment of any kind. It's almost a statistical story. When you have an election as close as this one appears to be right now, one wants to say it's almost random. I mean, that we're looking for somebody to just make a mistake and some dumb thing will happen, you know, a stumble coming on or off an airplane. I am not happy about this, but that's where, if anybody tells you they can tell you the outcome of this election right now, don't believe them.
That's Thomas Ferguson of the Institute for New Economic Thinking speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on July 9th, 2024.